So, Josephine Ensign here today, Wednesday, October 28th, 2015, in Jack Straw, and I'm here with Dr. David Carlbaum. Did I pronounce it correctly?
Yes.
Yes. And David is, as you know, we've talked in the past, this is for the Skid Road Project, and it's increasing an understanding of the complexity of charity healthcare in King County, and health being fairly widely understood, including social determinants of health. So the first question I have for you is, what led you to the work that you do? I know you have some really interesting stories there.
Yeah. I was a freshman at Whitman College in Walla Walla, and I had grown up on Bainbridge Island, and I had become an Explorer Scout in the fire department on Bainbridge Island, and essentially wanted to go to college and get a college degree, but emerge from college and become a firefighter. So even during college, I was working as a resident firefighter where I spent nights at the fire station and would respond as a firefighter while going to school. And there was an ad for an internship at Harborview, sponsored, I think, in part by Whitman, for someone to work in the emergency department. And it seemed like a good fit. I had obviously heard about the emergency department. I had met Dr. Kopis as an Explorer Scout. He had come to Bainbridge to do some teaching of paramedics and seemed interesting to me. I had zero idea what I was getting into. Before that, I had really worked in a bicycle shop repairing bikes and done some computer programming. And I think myself and my parents thought I would work for Microsoft as a computer programmer. This is about 1987. and so I took the job. And it was really a very different job. I thought it was going to be sort of stocking cupboards in the emergency department, but it really turned out to be washing people, taking blood pressures, taking vital signs, helping nurses care for patients, both sort of the more pleasant things and the unpleasant things, really. And it was amazingly, powerfully emotional. In all ways. So patients would, it's the first time in my life I've been bitten by a person. It's the first time in my life I'd been spit on by someone. And yet it was the first time I'd seen someone die in front of me, which I've seen many times now. And it never gets easier. And so it was really an interesting experience. And that was a sort of summer and winter job. So I worked in the summer for 3 months, and Whitman was on semester, so I worked in the winter for a couple months.
And so you're how old?
I'm 18.
18, okay.
19, I guess 19 by this point. and it was interesting, and it made me realize that maybe working with computers or repairing bikes wasn't what I wanted. And I guess what struck me also is there's just such a desperate need by people, by the patients. And there's something very satisfying about that camaraderie, about that teamwork, about shouldering together to help someone who's suffering, however small or great their suffering was, to think about how can you overcome the sadness of that moment and help them grow and move on.
So then you went back after that internship, and then so what happened then?
I continued to work throughout college in that internship, and I, after college, worked full time in the emergency department. I was working as what's called a medical assistant, so still the same stuff: stocking, supervising a team of volunteers. I usually had a couple of volunteers working for me. Taking care of patients and being the person on the healthcare team that was sort of what I might call the planner or the logistics person. So the person that when the physician, the surgeon, the internist would turn around and say, I need this to help care for the patient, I already have it and have it be handing it to them. And maybe it was easy because I worked there all the time and they were often residents rotating, but I got to understand the rhythm of resuscitation, the rhythm of surgical resuscitation, and understand kind of who needs what and be that sort of, in a way, the maitre d' of the emergency department, shepherding doctors where they needed to go, patients where they needed to go. And during that time, I continued to grow in my interest and become a paramedic. So I attended paramedic school, essentially, going through paramedic training, sitting in the back of the classroom as many days I was not working, intentionally working nights so I could then the next morning go to class, and just trying to learn as hungry for knowledge and experience. And finally, I think it was one afternoon, I also was working as a volunteer firefighter on Bainbridge Island at the time, living as a resident, so living at the fire station. And it was one, I don't know, drizzly Saturday afternoon after some big paramedic training drill on Bainbridge Island, and I was driving Dr. Copas back to the ferry. And in his very gruff and quiet voice, he just said, "Pull over." And I thought, oh, my God, I've just hit somebody or something, or a raccoon or a person. I don't know what's going on. And he said, "Turn off the car." And I turned off. We were in a fire department Suburban. Turned off the vehicle. And I just remember him saying, you need to go to medical school. You cannot be a paramedic. And what he told me was very interesting, and I hadn't thought about it until this morning. Again, he said, "There are tens of thousands of people that need you to be a doctor, and that you will touch many, many, many lives, and that is the path that you have to take." It's interesting because I hadn't really gotten much mentoring or counseling by my parents around this. I think they detested the fact I was in the fire department. I think it, you know, of course, scared my mother to death that I was standing on burning buildings, cutting holes in roofs. And I think they didn't understand that. My mom worked at a school and my father is a video engineer. And I think they didn't understand the intimacy of caring for people and how satisfying it is. And making those connections. And so this was the first time that someone sort of validated maybe what I had wanted to do all along. And it was powerful.
And so that was the first time that he had even mentioned that to you too?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I sort of backpedaled and said, well, but you know, thinking, oh my goodness, I want to be a paramedic. And that's when he said, if you try to be a paramedic, I will teach you all of medical school, which is 4 years, and all of residency, which is 4 years, in 1 year, and it will not be pleasant. And so both the sort of loving comment and the threat woven in one, which is right. A common occurrence.
So then, what did you do after that?
I applied to medical school. I returned and did some more science as a philosophy major at Whitman, so I needed a little bit more science, even though I had a minor in chemistry. And in my first year that I applied, it didn't go great. I think I applied one place. I think it was Case Western because it was an innovative educational program at the time, and they didn't take me. And the next year I interviewed all over and was accepted in the UW and chose to be a Washington whammy. So chose to get my education back again in southeastern Washington in the Palouse, where I lived in Moscow, Idaho. And we had school both in Moscow, Idaho and in Pullman, Washington.
And that was for the first 2 years?
That was for the first year.
First year, and then you came here.
Returned to Seattle
right.
For the remainder of our education.
Nice. And so during that time, were you still doing anything with Harborview, or I'm sure you were pretty busy.
Yeah, I wasn't working at Harborview anymore, but was still volunteering in the fire department. I don't know why they let me stay. I probably didn't meet minimum requirements of training or something, but still volunteering on Bainbridge Island on winter breaks and trying to learn medicine with the intention really of being a surgeon at the time was what I thought I was going to do.
And so what led you to the work that you're doing now? What was...
Yeah, I I think it was primarily in my fourth year. I had the opportunity to work as a sub-I, so to be work as if I was a first-year resident in the trauma surgical ICU at Harborview. And I remember my second-year resident, the one who sort of ran the ICU day-to-day, I think was probably depressed and kept not coming to work. And so I kept getting promoted and was comfortable caring for one patient at a time, and then two, and then three, and rounding on four, and presenting five. And I even had the opportunity to present on something called Mare Rounds. And so every Tuesday, all the nurses in the ICU, all the surgery residents and students and fellows, and would talk about cases admitted the night before. And it's very intimidating. And Ron Mayer, who is one of the original surgeons who came from Texas to Harborview with the sort of import or flight of the Texas surgeons in the 70s, early 70s, is an imposing figure who, like Dr. Kopis, has high standards. And I presented at Mayer Rounds. You present to him, and he stops you every sentence and grills you on the details, and was able to hold my own in discussion and do it. And that's where I really learned. I had the opportunity to go to the OR at the time too, and I did some hernia repairs and stuff with my residents. And I realized I didn't enjoy the OR at all. What I really liked was caring for really crazy sick patients and talking to their families. And so that's where I grew my love of critical care.
And so I would assume, like, during this time you still had interactions with Dr. Kopis around that.
Yeah. Every time I would see him in the hospital, of course, and I would go visit him, and he would ask how hard I was working and tell me I wasn't working hard enough, and provided guidance when it came time to choose residency. Mm. So, yeah, it was
good. He was kind of a person you went back to.
Yeah, yeah, continued to mentor me and father me.
Right.
So, and then I met my wife during medical school. We were in our third year of medical school, and we chose to, this was a brand new thing at the time, couples match, where we both got to do residency in the same city. And so we mm-hmm. went to Denver. And one of the experiences I had really wanted was to be the medic one doctor. So the medic one doctor is a physician who works in the Harview ED seeing patients, but at the same time supervises the medical care of all patients in the streets by the paramedics. And it was a role I had wanted, and I had that opportunity to come back as an away rotation from my residency in Colorado and do that. And I think I was the first person to ever not be a UW resident to do that role. And it was very interesting to come full circle back home, in a sense, and do that. And that's where I enjoyed that so much. I remember it was the December 1999, and the WTO riots were happening at the time. And it was crazy busy. It was really fun, you know. We worked 12-hour shifts. In a 12-hour shift, you would see 36 to 48 patients. You're constantly on the go, constantly riding, constantly trying to sneak in a bite of food somewhere along the way. And I enjoyed that, and teaching medical students at the same time. And I really enjoyed that environment. It was back home. It was caring for the people that were exigently sick and not so sick, but so sad. And working with that team, you know, working again with nurses who, even though as the team leader you were in charge, the nurses knew what needed to be done. And the nurses would coach you and guide you. Mm-hmm. So
the teamwork, and plus you were also working with the firefighters and paramedics
fit again.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
And having your charts dissected every morning by Dr. Kopis with a red grease pencil, writing cryptic things on them, you know, just giving you that feedback, pushing you to the edge, pushing everyone to their limits so that they would grow.
Yeah. So what have been your, like, biggest joys in your work?
Oh, interesting. I think, that's an interesting question. For me, I think it may not necessarily be about patience. It is always great to help someone through illness or crisis or trauma and to reconnect them with their family. I think that's pretty amazing. And it's overwhelming when you see them sometimes afterwards. Sometimes patients come back to the ICU. And you get to see that, see them whole again, and that's great. I think my biggest joy, though, is in teaching residents and teaching students and just sort of the joy of how to interact with people, how to see disease, how to see illness, how to see the path to helping someone find their health and find healing. And if you can't heal them, even to find something that's acceptable, even little things. So, you know, I worked for a long time in both the emergency department and then after my critical care fellowship, both the ED and the ICU. But in the ED, it's such a rich environment with learners. So you'd often be supervising 2 residents and 4 medical students and seeing all these patients and being able to help people see or have an aha moment about little details even. So, you know, someone with sinusitis who lives in a shelter, do you send them with an antibiotic that gives them diarrhea? That's pretty mean, actually, when there's 200 people sharing a toilet. So, you know, coaching them on those sort of more practical things.
Right. And then you also teach paramedics too, right?
Yeah. And so at that time, I was starting to teach paramedics and now I do it much more and I've been doing it much more for the past 10 years. And now as the director of paramedic training, I really get to watch them grow. And for me, that's watching them, especially because I'm more close with them and I work with them over the course of a year. Watching them make that transition, and you see it in medical students too and residents, but helping them through that transformation is really amazing. I mean, to me, they're standing on one, maybe as an analogy, they're standing on one cliff and they have to get to a cliff that's separated by a 1,000-foot drop to a river with a suspension bridge with every 3rd board broken that's blowing in the wind. And they have to be able to traverse that on their own, but with coaching. And it's that process of getting them to the other side and watching them let go of who they are and sometimes grieve who they are and become who they are going to be. It's very interesting.
Nice. And the who they're going to be in terms of just like the competency, a new role. What do you mean by the
side? I guess their new person. It's interesting. I think a lot of people think learning medicine is truly an apprentice of a trade, and it is. Thinking back long ago, the paramedic really is like the physician of the ancient Greeks. So the ancient Greeks had the thinking physician and the physician that did things, that was often a slave to the thinking physician, and that person could become technically competent. And so teaching paramedics in particular, it is about can they do a skill on a dying person? And so that part's okay, but for me, it's really about watching them grow and become the whole person that they are willing to be and become a leader, to become someone who's okay with standing next to someone who's dying and telling their family that they're going to be with them through this experience.
So how do you help to mentor them in being able to do that, especially on a long-term basis and not burning out?
That's interesting. I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that puzzle out. I do think striving for improvement always, I think, is good. I think teaching people how to simultaneously forgive themselves and yet think through critically an event and think about what small one thing they're going to do different the next time, I think, is always helpful.
So the kind of self-awareness,
yeah,
on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, I think sort of, I don't know if it's the right term, but teaching people to be mindful of themselves, of the patient, of the patient's experience. And to try to understand, I guess, a little bit about the patient. Recognize that, sure, it's the person that you've seen 5 times in the last month calling yet again for chest pain, but that person lives in a shelter and they're kicked out in their wheelchair and it's, you know, late November in Seattle where it's dark at 4:30 and it's pouring down rain and it's cold, and that maybe that's okay for that person to seek shelter in the hospital if they have no other place to seek shelter.
So helping them kind of figure out the context and valuing that.
Yeah, I think trying to get a deeper understanding of your patient's life always informs the decision. I mean, to me, disease is the thing that's happening to the person, but illness is the disease plus the person's experience. And that's so much more important. So
nice. So what have been some of the biggest challenges for you in your work personally?
There's some that maybe I don't want recorded.
Okay.
but I think for me it's it's overcoming what I might call a minimizer. So there's different philosophies in medicine, and I think personally I have the philosophy that in my perspective as both working as an emergency physician and now as a critical care physician in the ICU, my perspective is that everyone's dying and it's my fault. And whereas a primary care doctor might have the perspective that everyone's well and we'll figure out whatever minor perturbation is going on. And so from that perspective, I believe very strongly in sort of seeking disease, seeking answers. And over time, I encounter, not really in the paramedics, but more in physicians and residents, the residents that I might call a little anti-conservative, or maybe they're what you might call minimizers, or some people might call them lumpers versus splitters. And they sort of assume people are well. And I think in the context of someone arriving in the emergency department or someone arriving in the ICU, I think you should look a little harder. The burden of proof is on you to make sure that you're not missing something. Not often. There are times where by looking a little deeper, you uncover the secret, the key to the entire illness, or you're able to uncover even the story behind the illness and why this is different this time. And that's been my biggest challenge, is trying to convince those people who, in a way, unconsciously, I think, I hope, sort of write off the patient's illness a little bit. Or write off the person as maybe not mattering as much, not valuing that person and their personhood. And so I think that's the difference is for me, is I want to seek to understand that richer understanding. And so I go a little bit extra. You know, sometimes I might do a few more tests just to be safe. Just because I don't want to miss it. Because unfortunately, in the emergency setting or in the ICU setting, missing has consequences. And I guess maybe I'm not comfortable accepting those consequences always. And so negotiating that boundary sometimes with physicians who come from a different perspective, who come from the perspective of it'll all be okay, no big deal. What's the big deal? I often find that's the most personally challenging for me. I feel I really have to step back and sort of get fresh perspective and uncouple my emotions, because for me, there are times it just makes me livid that people don't care for these people. You know, they're like, they're different, they smell, they've got lice. They yell at me.
They bite my hand.
Yeah, they bite. They spit at me, whatever. You know, or they don't seem to respect me, or they don't want to talk to me, or they don't listen to what I do. I prescribe them medicine and they don't take it. Why should I value that person? And that just offends me so much. And maybe that's growing up under Dr. Kopus. I don't know.
Right. So how do you handle that?
Oh, interesting. I usually experience my emotion and try to let it pass through me. Often take a few deep breaths and recognize that probably that person is not intentionally doing that, but that there's some unconscious reason that they're thinking that or feeling that, and trying to explore that with them. And there are some people I think it works and some people it doesn't. And I don't know, it's just interesting. I try to model or mentor that to people, remembering that people are human, and hopefully that works. I try to now in the ICU teach residents to be open-hearted, to connect with patients, connect with families, talk to patients when you come in the room and they're on the breathing machine, you know, they're on the ventilator. Talk to every patient every day, even if they're unconscious. If I know that their brain probably doesn't work, I don't know, maybe.
You still talk to them.
Still talk to them, still touch them. You know, acknowledging patients, even though they may just look like a body in a bed on a ventilator, hooked to lots of different machines, and acknowledge their presence, acknowledge family. Even if the family is scary. Even if the family, you know, we deal a lot of times with families grieving or coming to terms or having anticipatory grief over someone's impending death, and I'm always amazed how different it is for different families and different cultures, and no family does it the same way. And I think there are some families that grieve in ways that scare residents, scare young doctors, and just be willing to be open-hearted and immerse yourself in that experience and see what happens.
Right.
And proceed as the way opens.
And so what kind of support and, like, ancillary staff and other kinds of resources do you help people call on in that setting? Like chaplains or?
Oh, interesting. I mean, for me, I think I don't know. I think I'm not trying to necessarily engage support. I mean, I think there's a couple. I do have resources that I use. Personally, I use palliative care physicians a lot, and I think I use them to help me with residents, and residents who are struggling with this too. I don't use the chaplains probably as much as I could, but also just try to ask people to be reflective, to be mindful, to take time to meditate, to take time to do whatever it is they do to reconnect with their people.
So this is the family members or
the residents? The physicians, the young physicians, yeah. Young residents. You know, I think lots of times they, you know, for an example, last week a physician said, you know, my husband doesn't do medicine. He doesn't understand. I can't tell him anything about my experience. And I think that's wrong, actually. I think you can. And maybe they don't know the technical details, but you can tell them what you feel about the experience. And so just getting people to connect and talk, I think, is helpful. And to, I don't know, I find myself telling people, both paramedic students and medical students and residents, two things more as I age. One, that I forgive them. And that I believe in them.
So you tell them that.
Yeah, it's strange.
Yeah, and how do they react? I'm sure different ways, but
it seems on balance that it somehow lifts a burden from them.
Yeah. So you do this, I would imagine, like in one-on-one kind of a
We're doing feedback at the end of a rotation.
Yeah. Nice. So is there like a actually the first one that goes in with, and you've mentioned some, but like what do you do for yourself in terms of preventing burnout?
Oh, interesting. Probably not enough. I'm an extreme introvert. And so for me, I restore my energy and by doing things like sort of an introvert's date where my wife and I will sit in front of the fireplace with our cat and read our books together and, you know, converse some but not always just being, knowing that that's such a safe place and that, you know, having that connection with her. I should exercise more. I don't. I work to forgive myself for my imperfections. Not always easy.
And so how do you do that? Like, do you wake up and say, what do I need to forgive myself for today? Or is there a practice or journaling?
Yeah, I think
how do you do that?
Yeah, I'm not a very good journaler. I'm not a very good writer. Despite being a philosophy major, it all my writing happened in college and sort of burnt out on writing. Usually just reflective practice. My daily life is that I depart my house at 4:45 in the morning to walk to a bus, to catch a ferry, to walk up the hill to Harborview. I usually walk in the pitch black without a light on my route to the bus and just reflect on the day and what things I'm grateful for from the previous day. And I also forgive myself.
So a lot of it happens in the mornings, and then when you retrace your steps in the evening, do you have anything that you do?
Oh, interesting.
Then?
Less so then. I think the evening is maybe some reflection. The evening is symbolically putting away, closing the chapter on work on Harborview. I often sit outside on the ferry for as much of the year as I can, sometimes outside undercover, but outside. And there's something very satisfying about watching the city and Harborview too. That tower built in the 30s that's so iconic and so small on the city skyline now, watching it shrink from being enormous when you leave the dock in Seattle to when I arrive home on Bainbridge Island, having it be barely visible.
So it's a literal and a kind of a metaphysical distancing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, watching the route of the ferry turns to enter the harbor. And as it goes into Eagle Harbor, you usually, if it's clear, get an amazing view of Mount Rainier. And so sort of watching the city life shrink and the natural life come back.
Right.
And then by intention, we live very rural in the woods.
Nice. So those are things that you do to help with perspective and prevent burnout.
Yeah.
So what one of the memorable moments is when it sounds like when you were pulled over early in your career and told you need to go to medical school. But any other memorable moments that stand out for you over your career?
I mean, I think not any one particular moment. There are many, 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 many times of meeting with families about the loss of their loved one that are very memorable, and about being with patients while they die, which are very memorable. And about being with patients when they're dead and become alive again. I mean, I think for me, it's interesting. So I have become more reflective as I've gotten older, and just watching the world a little bit more, and thinking about who I am in comparison to Dr. Kopus. Everyone assumes I am the next coming of Dr. Kopus. Which is both good and bad. And I'm not him at all. I have some similar values, but I'm certainly not him. And just trying to watch who I have become has been interesting. And thinking about what things matter to me in teaching and working through some of those struggles about belonging, not belonging. Some of that stuff. It's been really interesting. So I don't have any remarkably particularly memorable moments. There will be moments of patient experiences that I will always remember. A blinding snowstorm on Bainbridge Island where as a fourth year medical student, Judy and I were together and went to a cardiac arrest where it was only the Subaru we were driving that could make it up an exceedingly snowy driveway. Working a cardiac arrest for an hour in the snow, on the front porch of someone's home, where obviously this elderly gentleman had a myocardial infarction and then cardiac arrest from shoveling snow. And just that teamwork and hope of that experience, the fact that, and this were Seattle paramedics at the time who were working on Bainbridge Island, it struck me as, being a fourth-year student as a little bit cynical about life probably by that point in time and just thinking, what the hell are we going to do if we get the guy resuscitated? Load him in the Subaru and drive down the driveway, and yet the total hope and culture of this guy's going to live unless he doesn't. We're going to do everything we can, and that was interesting to me.
And you were married by then?
No, we weren't.
You were dating.
Yeah. We were dating. This might have been Judy's first experience to a cardiac arrest, I think.
So how did that story turn out?
He died. Yeah. And it was really nice. His wife was there. It's strange to say a death is nice, but I think deaths can be nice. And I think it was a good death. His wife was there and got to be there with him. And for me, I learned a lot because I got to watch Judy, my girlfriend at the time, and now my wife, be with her. And it reminded me of how amazing a person she is and her ability to connect to people. She had just met this person for the first time in her life. And 30 seconds later, it's like they're best friends. Mm-hmm. And, supporting her, et cetera.
Right.
Through that.
It's a very, very intimate moment on many different levels.
Yeah. That's interesting. Because there is that intimacy of being there.
Yeah. So, didn't mean to bring you to tears, dear David. But obviously, that's a memorable moment.
I think I have maybe one other.
Okay.
That's debating whether or not to share this. Very close friend of mine who. Whose mother was run over run over by a car while while walking with his children. And she saved his children's life by protecting them. And she died there and was resuscitated by the medics and brought to the ICU where I work. I thankfully was not their doctor. But my friend asked if I could counsel him, advise him. She was, you know, had a horrible brain injury and was not waking up. And he's very realistic and reasonable and wanted to allow her natural death. And I got to be there making sure that she was not suffering. And it's something we do a lot, but I'm not always at the bedside the moment someone dies. I have been a lot. I think sometimes as physicians, we distance ourselves a little bit from that. You know, and the ICU nurses are the ones at the bedside. And this time was different. This time I was at the bedside with them. And helped, you know, I was the one that actually physically gave the medicines to make sure that her breathing was comfortable and she wasn't anxious as she died. And it was it's the first time I've ever done that. After writing for comfort care orders for a decade, it was the first time I was actually the one to give the medicine that facilitated her comfortable death. And and again, it was just an amazingly intimate moment to be with the family as they grieved, and somehow very powerful too. And yet I think it was the probably the best gift I could have given my friend ever.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of simultaneously doing different roles there, but that sounds like they all kind of came together.
Yeah.
As your friend,
it was
physician. Yeah.
It was this nexus of experiences that was very powerful.
Right. Nice. So is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you'd want to talk about at all during this? Like what? So what are your hopes for the future? For all of this kind of care within King County.
I have hopes and I have fears. I think I worry a little bit, and I'm concerned a little bit that that Harborview is lost right now, and that maybe losing its way as far as caring for what I would call its mission population, its key people, the underserved, the homeless, the non-English speaking immigrants who can barely understand how to take a bus, let alone take a medicine. And horribly, horribly ill with psychiatric disease. And I worry that in an effort to, you know, keep the doors open, to be financially sustainable, to be bigger, better, faster, that sometimes that reflective introspection has been lost a little bit, and that to stay. You know, to stay Mother Harborview, to stay that place that's up on the hill that, you know, always has your back. Maybe that's not the right path to that. I don't know the right path. I think there's a middle ground. I think there's a way to be bigger, better, faster, financially sustainable, and yet still keep that mission. And I think there are people everywhere within Harborview working hard to do that. But sometimes it feels like there's a little bit of a disconnect at times. And I know there have been recent struggles, you know, the proposal to close community clinics, the fact that the King County Council is even opening the possibility of not renewing a contract with the university over these types of issues is interesting. And I think the wrong path. You know, to me, the Harvey way is, yes, how can we help? And there are times when I don't hear that, and there are times when I hear, are you turning away from helping small communities? Well, can you go look for a bed somewhere else? We're kind of full, or we're busy. And I understand there are constraints, but it just seems like my romanticized memory of Harvey when I arrived was a place where it was dirty and grimy and hardworking, and it is blue collar, and everyone was shouldering the burden together, and it sucked sometimes, but everyone did it. And I'm not sure if everyone in the leadership of Harvey recognizes that. You know, if you were to read Audrey's book, House of Hope and Fear, you know, Alice, I worked in that role. There were five of us sharing a role as Dr. Copas' assistant. And the book is about Alice, really, because she's probably the most interesting of the five of us. But we all shared those day-to-day decisions and struggles and fighting for the mission population. And it just feels like we're maybe a little lost. My hope is that we'll refine that connection, and I think we will. I think you're starting to see more and more younger physicians more interested in that. I think people don't enter into medicine anymore to make money. I think they enter into it to change the world, and I hope that a lot of the people that are interested in global health recognize that a lot of those same issues are happening here. And a lot of those same skills that they learn on a month rotation in Kenya are things that they can use here.
Including the language.
Including the languages, yeah. Right. And that we have just as many desperately needy people blocks,
right.
Less than a block.
And systems right. issues that need to be addressed.
Yeah, and yeah. systems issues and are in need of innovation
yeah.
And are in need of rethinking to the core. I mean, it makes me think about, so Dr. Copas had a stroke and retired, and we brought him back. He's been back twice to talk to the paramedics, who he really is a father to every single one of them. And I remember we were bundling him up. It was wintertime, January, February, to return back to his home, to catch the ferry and return back to his home. And he sort of stopped us all in a very sort of kingly way.
And said, pull the ferry over.
Yeah, we're in the apparatus bay. So we were loading him into his vehicle in the garage that's attached to the hospital, right? The only hospital that we know of that has a fire station attached to it or within it. And he said, stop just a second. And this was right after I had told him I loved him and that I would see him, you know, in a month or so. And he said, maybe you figured this out, but maybe you haven't. But just in case you haven't, let me tell you. And he told me that there's a river of love that flows underneath this place. And the way to do better and to continue to do better and be a force for good is to connect to that river of love. And if people can't connect to that river of love, they won't survive this. And that is the magic of this place.
Nice.
So
that's a beautiful thought, I think, to end on. That I can see him saying that to you after having only met him once. But anything else, or you feel like that's where you would like to end it?
Sure.
Okay. So I want to thank you for taking time today and sharing your experiences and powerful stories. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for helping me weave the story of this place into my life.
Yeah, thank you.